There are some common misconceptions about groundwater. Groundwater does not exist in the way that surface water does, as large bodies in isolation, like lakes and rivers. It's mostly very small drops that exist within cracks or pore spaces within soil or rock. One way of thinking about it is if you have a bucket of sand, if it's dry sand, and you can then add water to that bucket. If you do it slowly, you will be filling up the pore spaces around the individual grains of sand. Groundwater is always moving. It is not stationary, although we draw it in these pictures and it looks stationary. It flows toward rivers in general. Ultimately and eventually, groundwater will flow back to major streams and from there down to the ocean. Groundwater is what feeds streams. If you've lived in the Palouse in July and August, you know it generally doesn't rain much, but Paradise Creek and the Palouse River are still running. They are fed from underneath by groundwater moving up into the streams. I photocopied a recent article in the Daily News, and it has a figure similar to this. Okay, let's start over here in Pullman. As you know, there's soil material, wind-blown soil that makes our rolling hills at the very surface, and then below that is lava rock called basalt rock. The shallow layers of the basalt rock make up what we call the Wanapum Aquifer. Below that, there is some kind of barrier in the basalt that at least inhibits the flow of water from the Wanapum to the Grand Ronde. That flow may occur very slowly, but it's very slow, small quantities on a human scale. Below that is rock we call the Grand Ronde Aquifer. So that's also basalt rock. The city of Pullman and WSU are entirely reliant on the Grand Ronde Aquifer and have been for the last several decades. The water that's at this great depth is quite old, 15, 20,000 years old, meaning it's been down there that long. So it's water from the Ice Age. There are two principal results from that. There is no human contamination, no pesticide, herbicide, and so on in this deep groundwater. The second result, if you live in Pullman, you know that the water is hard all year round. Lots of dissolved silica and other ions in it. We think that these aquifers extend over to Moscow as well. We think that because the basalt rock extends over there. But in recent years, we've been finding that when the U of I and Moscow pump on their wells, when they're removing water from their wells, we do not see it in Pullman. The water level in our wells does not drop. And that suggests there's some kind of barrier between Pullman and Moscow. In fact, maybe more than one. To our surprise, even some of the Moscow wells do not drop when certain Moscow wells are pumping. So on a very short scale, there is not as much continuity in these aquifers as we had assumed as geologists. In fact, there's at least one Moscow well, which if you pump, if you remove water from it, will give an effect in the town well of Palouse, okay, which is a long way away. Okay, farther than Pullman, but you won't see it in Pullman and you will see it in the town of Palouse. Moscow Mountain is made of different rock. It's not basalt. It's granite rock, the white rock you're used to seeing up on Moscow Mountain. And the principal difficulty for geologists in thinking about the Naylor Farm proposal is that the Naylor Farm is roughly on the border between the granite and the basalt. And geologists, for good reason, disagree a bit about what's below the surface here. It may be fresh granite to some extent, or it may be highly weathered granite. That's an important difference because highly weathered granite will have spaces, pore spaces in it, which will allow for potentially significant groundwater reserves. If Naylor Farms is given the water rights, and if they drill a deep well, they may run into mostly fresh granite, in which case they won't be able to remove much water, probably. Okay, that's what most geologists would say. And if you're familiar with small water wells on Moscow Mountain, that's the problem. In fresh granite, it's hard to get much water to remove. It's also possible that they'll be into weathered granite and will be able to remove a lot of water. City of Moscow and U of I fear that, worried that it may interfere with either the Wanapum or the Grand Ron. And Moscow uses both to some extent. From my point of view as a geologist, just as a technical matter, if I had to bet a year's salary, I would bet they'll hit fresh granite and they will not be able to remove much water. Still own the water rights, I guess, the lawyer will tell us. But potentially not be able to remove much water at all. On the other hand, if they can remove a lot of water, that might be a good thing because it might be a groundwater resource we don't know about at present. It might not affect these aquifers. It may be a separate system, in which case we will have gained a new resource or knowledge of a new resource in the area. The fear among some geologists, however, is that it will affect one or the other or both, at least in the long term, at least in the scale of a few decades. That's what I know about the local geology and the aquifer. I'm not the expert on this, but if you read the article from the Daily News, you'll find the academic geologists, both at the U of I and WSU, who are the experts. Thanks.
My name is Tom Townsend. I'm a resident of Moscow and have been for a long time. And am a member of the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee and have been involved with that group and its predecessors for about the last 25 years or so. And I'll give you a very short overview of what it is and what we try to do and things like that. The concerns about water are not something new. I mean, this has not just come to the fore in the last two or three years. Water supply in Moscow has been discussed since the 1930s, and we've had committees in Moscow talking about the water supply ever since that point in time. The people have been from the university and from the city, and they've had various degrees of having studies done, and probably this aquifer is probably looked at both by WSU graduate students and U of I graduate students as much as any other place. It's like a campus with an engineering school. It has been surveyed. Every inch and cranny is well identified by coordinates. So it's not a new issue. But I think what is new is the degree of awareness. There's a much wider public interest these days, and it has taken a long time to get here. In 1982, I was on the city council, and we did a survey, actually handed out questionnaires to residents of Moscow, asked them about water, where they thought it came from and where it was going and all this kind of stuff. And many of the responses came back, you know, the water came out of the tap, and that was as far as it went. I mean, they had no idea where it came from. They, you know, it could have come from the Snake River. It could have fallen from the skies. It was brought in by tanker truck from Orofino. I mean, it was just sort of a bizarre, great evening going out. And we dropped, the city council members dropped these questionnaires off, and we went back within 2 hours and picked them up. So we had a sort of interesting survey that sort of was disconcerting. In the 1980s, the interest in water began to pick up. I became concerned when WSU put in a water right application, and for a well that could pump 2,500 gallons a minute. And that's all it said, 2,500 gallons a minute. And I said, you know, how many minutes are you guys pumping that thing? And, you know, if you maximized it out, they would take all the water. And I said, I don't think anybody's going to pump that long, but I'm not sure. And inquired through the legal process, through an appeal, to ask them on what basis were they going to do things and how many acre feet of water were they intending to take. And did they do any kind of environmental thing? Well, they did an environmental investigation or assessment, and it went as far as the end of the runway at the Pullman Moscow Airport. And I said, that sort of sounds like the flat Earth theory. The end, you know, does the Earth stop at the end of the runway of the Pullman Moscow Airport? And I said, no, we are all in the same hole. We just have different straws. And that was very disconcerting to find that at that point in time, I inquired of the state of Idaho, did they care that the state of Washington was having this, what I termed a sort of a raid on a communal water source, and they basically said, no, we don't care. And I took a trip to Boise and got in a big fight, and the next day they did file a complaint. The state of Idaho did file a complaint about it, and the University of Washington State University did back off and concede that this was a replacement well, and it was a no-gain kind of thing. They would shut down other wells and all this kind of stuff. So that came to a reasonable conclusion. However, that didn't stop. I mean, it just indicated what was going on, that the communities and the universities on both sides of the state line sort of did what the hell they wanted to do without telling anybody else. I mean, it was just, you know, free game. And we operate on water rights. I mean, people in WSU and Pullman have water rights issued by the state of Washington. We have our water rights issued by the state of Idaho. And we're all sovereign entities in that sense. And it's like the Russian-American missile race. I mean, you can do anything you want as long as you there's no legal binding of saying anything about WSU pumping too much water. It's on their side of the line, and they can do what they want, and we don't have a great deal of legal say-so about it, except when they change the place of usage or they first apply for a water right. That's about the only time you get to stick your oar in the water. So there was a great deal of a lack of cooperation between the states, and being somewhat of a dissident by nature, I did contact the heads of the water resources, both in Washington, who at that time was the Department of Ecology, run by Christine Gregoire, and Department of Water Resources in Idaho, in Boise, and I can't remember who it was at the time. And I said, do you guys ever talk to each other? And the question was, no, they don't talk to each other. And I said, do your ancillary units around here ever talk to each other? No, they don't do that. I said, well, I'd be glad to invite you to Moscow, and I'll buy you dinner or whatever it is so we can talk about it because we have a common problem. And that sort of started off on a more, I wouldn't say a congenial basis, but we started off on a coordinated program. And the cities of Moscow and Pullman generated about $40,000 to create a contract to have the U.S. Geological Survey create a computer model of our local aquifer, the Wanapum and Grand Ronde, to try and figure out what was going on. And I think you all are aware that for the last number of years, we were losing about a foot and a half of water per year out of the aquifer. We have exhaustively studied this thing to figure out what it is. The computer model hopefully was assuming that we could reach an equilibrium status if we would reduce our pumping. In other words, it's like a horse trough that has a little drippy water coming into it, and it the horses drink out of it fast enough so it doesn't overflow and waste the water. I mean, you come to a level line. And we thought that if we could reduce our water pumpage over a period of time, and we decided as a group that we would reduce our pumping not to exceed a 1% increase per year over a running 5-year average. Well, the two universities, I have to admit, have done very well. They do better than we do, than the cities do, because the state can really lay the arm to them. The state of Washington, the governor put an edict out and told WASU to reduce their water usage by X percent. And the University of Idaho has not been strong-armed in that way, but has been using the effluent from the sewer treatment plant that would otherwise flow down Paradise Creek, and it's all free, and they can use all they want, and they irrigate the golf course and the playing fields out, out Wicks Field and all that is irrigated with effluent, treated effluent, and has worked for a long time. It's a free source of water. In fact, WSU was talking about having a golf course and putting a new golf course. And when I was the chairman of PBAC a couple of years ago, I said, well, we'll give you the water. Just, we'll put it in a pipe and run it down the Chipman Trail, and you can have it for free. Well, that didn't, I don't know what, there was some problem with that with them. They would prefer to ship it over the hill from their sewage treatment plant. Ours is obviously not good enough. I don't know, but it was a way to get rid of water. So as in the 1980s, as we progressed forward, we started to work together, and the Geological Survey did the computer modeling. It always assumed that we were going to get a certain amount of rainfall, there would be a certain amount of transpiration from the crops, and we would get a certain amount of water going into the soil that we just discussed. The amount of water that was being absorbed into the soil, I think they talked originally about the recharge about 3 inches a year, something like that. Well, that has, over the years, has not proven to be true at all. I mean, if it's, I don't even want to mention what number we've recently thought about it, but it's far less than 3 inches. We have seen absolutely no change in the age of the water in the Grand Ronde, and you can carbon date it pretty well. We've done isotope studies, we've done sound studies, sonar studies, all kinds of things to try and figure out. We've tried to figure out how big the basin is, how deep it is, whatever its boundaries. And where is this water that falls on it go? And it's a mystery. And it's one of these kind of things. You turn over a rock, you open that up, and then you find another rock, and you turn that over, another question. It just goes on and on and on. We have used the resources of both universities to the maximum degree. And we're just now finishing up a 3-year study being done by Kent Keller and Jim Oshinsky. Keller's from WASU. And Jim Oshinsky is the hydrogeologist at the U of I, and they have been working on these projects, and we're trying to figure out, we're taking on water, it's just not, we can't figure out where it goes or what's going on down there, and our model cannot be verified because you can take a known period of time and run it to the computer, and it doesn't come out right at all. But our wells keep going down. And we have, just to explain very quickly, some of the things we've tried to do, we have turned on all of our pumps simultaneously to see what happens. And as you mentioned, there have been, sometimes we can get wells in Colfax to react to when we turn our wells on, and Palouse. I mean, they all don't work everybody doesn't go down simultaneously or anything like that. But we have connections, and we have barriers, but we don't know where all the connections are, nor do we know where all the barriers are. And we've often, for a long time, thought that water was leaking out of the seepages on the breaks of the Snake River. And you can check, you can test water for isotopes, like, to find out what kind of, and the water is obviously different. The water in the Wanapum is a different type, is a different chemical water than the water in the Grand Ronde. But we can't figure out where all this water is going. We're not using it all by any means, but we're losing it, but we don't know to whence are we losing it. So we're more focused, and the committee has been reformed. We have a memorandum of agreement, which is about 10 years old now, between the two universities, the two cities, and the two counties. That's everybody. Cities, universities, counties. That's it. we agreed to try to work together cooperatively together, so that no one person is snatching all the water, and we have consensus opinions on what we're trying to do and what our long-range programs are going to be. I'll wrap it up in just a second. So far, we've done quite well, and we are under stress from the state of Idaho because we are taking more water out of the ground than what's coming in, and that's called mining, and that's prohibited by law. And the only thing that's saving us from any kind of draconian measure by the state is the fact that we've established this procedure, Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee, to work together trying to solve local problems on a local basis rather than having somebody in Boise tell us what to do. And in closing this down, we have one of the adjuncts or appendices to our communal memorandum of agreement. We have an agreement with the state of Idaho and the state of Washington that they will be our legal backers in any problem that comes up concerning water rights. And we were supposed to have been notified of any new water rights that came past the state of Idaho, for instance. They failed to tell us that the Naylor people had filed a request. So at this point in time, we are not a legal intervener, nor is Latah County. The only two legal entities in the pot right now is the city of Pullman and the city of Moscow. I don't know any more about the negotiations between Naylor's and the city of Moscow and Pullman, because that's a closed issue to us right now. And when the state of Idaho opens up the door and to whatever they're going to do, administrative hearings, we will become involved. But at the moment, we're not. So that's what we try to do, and we work on our studies, and everybody pays a part of the fees, and both since the cities and the cities are revenue producers of water, they are putting far more money in the pot than the rest of us. So that's our local control mechanism. It had a slight failure because we didn't read the Saturday legal notice in the paper and catch it in time. But we'll be back in legal form when the private negotiations are completed. Thanks a lot.
Last July, myself and several other individuals started an organization called the Palouse Water Conservation Network. The mission of our organization is to promote community awareness, education, and action to preserve our underground water resources. Since we formed, we've been mostly mired down in the process of achieving nonprofit status, which I think a few more months we'll be there. We've also started a website, which we hope someday will be a kind of a one-stop shopping source for information about our groundwater and how to conserve it. Most of what we'd like to do is geared towards public education, and the reason for that is because there is so little public education coming from our city governments or from the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee. As Dr. Peters and Tom also have given you a picture of, our sole source of water, 90% of it, is this system of deep Grand Ronde aquifer that contains ancient water. There's no evidence that there is any recharge to it. It appears to be, until proven otherwise, a one-time source of water. And we're going through that water like there's no tomorrow. And if we continue, there may not be any tomorrow. A number of alternative water sources have been suggested over the years since this problem was kind of detected, and some of those, the first ones that were looked at were bringing in water from somewhere else. Proposals were to bring it in from the Snake River, perhaps from the reservoir behind Dworshak Dam, maybe even from the Palouse River. You know, pump the water in here and treat it and use it. Those options were studied by the Army Corps of Engineers about 20 years ago, I think. And at the time, they were considered to be too costly, and there were questions of feasibility. So, you know, that was kind of put on the back burner. Other alternative sources of water would be one that's been talked about is using the effluent that is now watering the golf course and other areas at the university, using that water to either treat and pump back into our supply system or recharge that water to the deep or the shallow aquifer in an attempt to improve the amount of water going back into the aquifers. That idea obviously has some questionable features that would have to be worked out regarding contaminants that we might be introducing either into our water supply system or our groundwater. And I think just on a kind of a gut level basis, I don't know that this community is ready to start using treated sewage for our water supply. Probably the best alternative water supply we have is, you know, what we've had out in great quantity the last few days is rain and snow. I wasn't able to find an official statistic. I did a quick calculation. It looks like we have, in an average year, about 15 times more water coming in the form of rain and snow than what we pump out of the Grand Ronde Aquifer every year. Now, there are a lot of problems involved in trying to use that water, trying to collect it, purify it, store it. You know, we go through 4 or 5 months in the summer with relatively little precipitation, and so you have to have some way to, if you're going to depend on precipitation, you have to have some way to collect and store that water during the wet months and keep it around to use during the dry months. And that will be a difficult problem to solve if we end up going that way sometime. But the only really ready source of new water or replacement water that we have is conservation. And you can say, well, that's not really new water. But if you think about it, a gallon of water that we don't pump out of the ground and use today is still there tomorrow or the next day or maybe 100 years from now for someone else to use. And since any of the other alternative water supplies that we might develop at some point will take many years, if not decades, to develop and will take a heck of a lot of money to implement, the only way to do anything in the short term to protect or preserve the underground water is to use less of it. And at this point, I mean, anybody who's, you know, been around town and watched sprinkler systems watering pavement, you know, running off into the storm sewers, we're wasting an awful lot of water. And the first step that we should be undertaking is conserving the resource that we have. And hopefully it will last until we have a replacement resource that will give us a dependable, sustainable supply of water. So there's a lot more I can say about that. Hopefully I'll get a chance later.
Thank you, Bill.
Okay. All right, I'm Rachel Osborne. I'm an attorney in Spokane. I focus my practice on water law and water rights. I'd like to first just look at a slightly bigger picture here. Water, of course, is a topic of abiding concern to communities throughout the state of Idaho. From the Magic Valley, where they're undergoing an onslaught of industrial dairies, to the Snake River tributaries, where water has to be shared between fish and agriculture, to the Rathdrum Prairie, which has been targeted as a prime real estate for water-eating power plants. Water is a resource and an issue that is of concern throughout the state. So you who care so deeply about your local water resources, your aquifer, are in good company. And indeed, you are in good company with the rest of the world. It's not very well known, but 2003 has been designated by the United Nations as the International Year of Fresh Water. And in fact, March 22nd is International Water Day. There are 1 billion people in the world who do not have access to adequate supplies of clean water. Whereas we in the United States, on the other hand, rank at the top of the charts for our per capita water consumption. So there is much belt tightening that can be done, and I would suggest quite a bit before we even really begin to feel the pinch. I think Bill is exactly right about that. That said, I'm here to talk tonight about Idaho water law, which I learned last year in the Rathdrum Power Plant proceedings, and how it may serve you. I am glad to report to you that, in fact, Idaho water law endorses the concept of protection of aquifers as well as the protection of local communities. This occurs through implementation of 6 criteria that are set forth in the Idaho Water Code. When someone proposes to use water in Idaho, virtually any use except very small use requires a water right or water permit. Application is made to the Department of Water Resources, and I understand the Naylor application is one of concern to the community. IDWR analyzes whether to grant a water right using 6 criteria, and I would like to talk to you tonight about 2 of the criteria that it must apply. The first involves water availability, whether water is physically and legally available in the source of supply. And second, the topic of local public interest, which is protected under the Water Code. So first, let's talk about water availability. It makes sense, but just to state the obvious here, water has to be available for a proposed appropriation in order to grant a permit to it. It's actually got to be out there. A water permit application must be rejected if the water supply is not sufficient for the purpose for which the water right is sought. This general provision is given some contour in the context of Idaho groundwater law, which forbids, as Tom said, the mining of aquifers. And I might add here that if you've got an aquifer that's dropping a foot and a half a year, you've got a serious problem around here. Interestingly, the Grand Ronde Aquifer extends throughout the Columbia Plateau, and I've worked on issues relating to dropping water levels in the Grand Ronde Aquifer in the Yakima Basin, a couple hundred miles from here, where presently there's a $6 million USGS study underway to determine exactly what is going on with the aquifers over there, same aquifers. To determine whether water is available in an aquifer, one must determine whether the allocated water rights exceed, equal or exceed what is called the future annual average recharge to the aquifer. In other words, is what going out equal to or more than what's coming in? Obviously, if what's going out exceeds what's coming in, then you have a non-sustainable situation. I would suggest there is a non-sustainable situation going on with your aquifers here, although the reasons for that apparently are not entirely certain. In a Supreme Court case in 1973, the Idaho Supreme Court spoke about what these groundwater law, this groundwater law means in the case of Baker versus Ore-Ida, where the court said, the real problem is how to best utilize the annual supply without overdrafting the stock, which maintains the aquifer's water level, and in no uncertain terms held that mining of aquifers is forbidden in Idaho. So that is the short answer to the question of availability. You've got to show that water is there and that it is not being used already at a non-sustainable level. The second criterion that I want to talk about for the grant of an application, water right application, is known as the local public interest. And the local public interest is generating a lot of attention these days because in Idaho there is a proposal in the state legislature to amend the test as it is presently written in the water code. And this is a matter of great concern to communities throughout the state and should be a matter of concern to you. The local public interest test was added to the water code in 1978, and it requires the Idaho Department of Water Resources to consider the affairs of the people in the area directly affected by the proposed use. It's a very broad test, and it allows the state to consider a whole lot of different things that aren't technically considered in a technical water availability analysis or a impairment to senior users analysis. Under the local public interest test, IDWR will analyze a variety of environmental factors as well as economic factors. Environmental impacts might include harm to fish and wildlife, obviously more of a consideration in the context of surface waters, although I might say, I guess the one thing I would add to Kirsten's excellent lecture is that there is another law out there we all have to obey, and that is the law of physics known as mass is conserved. There is no free lunch. If you take the water out of the aquifer here, it's going to affect something somewhere else. Economic impacts that IDWR will look at the costs and benefits to communities of a particular proposed water use. These might include employment costs and so forth, but I would add in the Rathdrum power plant cases last year, we looked at the question of if all of the water that is proposed to be taken in that situation is taken by the power plants and evaporated, what about the water that might be needed by the community for future growth and perhaps even survival? These are the kinds of factors that might be considered under the local public interest test. And by the way, the attempt in Boise right now to change the statute would severely limit the ability of the agency to consider that kind of factor. I would also add that the local public interest test allows Idaho to look at impacts in Washington State, where there is a shared water resource, which appears to be the case here. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about it. When you share an aquifer, there are a lot of reasons Idaho might look at what's going on in Washington around here, but the least altruistic reason is that what's going on in Washington may come boomerang right back into and affect Idaho. So it's in Idaho's interest to do that. Again, in the Rathdrum power plant cases, under the local public interest test, the hearing officer did accept and consider evidence concerning what was going on with the Spokane aquifer in Washington State. From a procedural standpoint, the local public interest test provides an important coordination function between state agencies. It directs applicants to consult with interested agencies, local governments, and tribes so that it is through this process that IDWR learns what the public interest issues are for the particular issue or project that it's looking at. Local public interest allows Idaho, the hearing officer in protested water right cases, to accept testimony from public witnesses, people just like you. All kinds of folks showed up at the Rathrum Power Plant hearing to testify. Farmers, business people, politicians, and so forth, to talk about what they felt the concerns were. Often this can be the only way that local concerns are expressed in the agency process. Finally, and I think this is very important in the situation that you're confronted with here, for all of the criteria under the Water Code, the burden of proof is on the applicant. It is the applicant's burden to show that water is available. It is the applicant's burden to show that there will be no harm to the local public interest. So you have you're in a situation where it is the applicant who must come forward with affirmative evidence to show that there is not going to be a harm of some kind that will result from the proposed application. It is not the burden of the agency or the community to show that there will be harm. Finally, I'd like to point out that in all of this, that the Idaho Department of Water Resources, the state agency that issues water rights, has an independent duty to assess the criteria for issuance of water right permits. All groundwaters are the property of the state. The state holds them in trust for the public. That means you. As the agency that's delegated responsibility to supervise water rights, IDWR must ensure that the water resource, the Mosco Pullman Aquifer, is managed in a way that comports with statutory requirements, right? In other words, IDWR has an independent duty to determine whether water is available, to determine that aquifer mining is not going to occur, and to determine that the local public interest will not be harmed. In sum, I'd like to say that the Idaho Water Code gives you a lot to work with. It sounds like there is a contested proceeding occurring. I could see that there might be some opportunities to hold the cities who are the protesters to account for the negotiations that are going on right now through political processes. There's also the potential to intervene in the proceedings to open them up and to determine what is actually going on. And finally, which I leave it to you to figure out how to do that, but I would urge you to participate in contacting legislators in Boise about the proposal to amend the local public interest test. That test is very important to you right now. There's a petition here tonight that has been put together by the Civic Association, and I would urge you to sign it. Thank you very much.
I had a comment. Bill is right. The educational process locally is not as effective as it could be. However, there are the Aquifer Committee has educational programs in place. It's difficult. Our water department provides all kinds of water saving devices at no charge to the public. This information is not hidden. It's not emblazoned on giant posters downtown anywhere. But this stuff is out there, and it's very difficult, though, to get it spread widely throughout the community. We have low-flow shower heads, low-flow gizmos that go on your sink faucets and things like that. We live in a community full of students, and passing these things out, sometimes they get put on, sometimes they don't, they get thrown away. We try to make it conservation, but it's a difficult process, and I commend if that group can make an impact on the community for water conservation, we're certainly all for it. We're trying to find out what's going on. At the same time, we are also interested in conservation, but I admit that it's not our highest priority. It's a secondary, tertiary priority. But it's just impossible to do everything simultaneously sometimes.
Thank you. I'd like to open it up for questions from the audience.
Dr. Peters, based on what you told us, it would seem that a fundamental necessity of the theory that Naylor would discover a new source of water would be that there's a barrier between both the Grand Ronde and one of the aquifers and this area. I guess that's an assumption in the
essence
that's correct.
These are the Naylor guys.
If that's correct, is there any evidence yet to support that theory?
I think that is correct. Okay. That to be a separate, different water supply, there would have to be a barrier. I don't think there is any evidence for or against that in a significant way right now, because we don't know what is below there yet. And that's a problem for us geologists all the time. Until we drill, we don't know what's there. Most people aren't willing to put thousands of dollars into a well unless they're promised a right to the products of that well. So if the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee had millions of dollars each year to spend, they could drill, and I would hope they would be drilling. As I understand it, you know, there's one test well in the works, potentially, and that's taken Kent Keller and Jim a long time to get the money together for that. So we don't have enough data to, from what I know, to comment significantly on that.
I'm Mike Beals. My name is John Timberling. I've been serving under City Council for about 5 months now, and I think I can speak a little bit, maybe have a little information to the status of the negotiations. It's been about a month since the city had a report, and at that actual meeting, Mr. Lemke and Mr. Thompson were there. They knew it was on our agenda. They came up and spoke to us, and you know, one of the interesting things about this, and perhaps the attorneys can speak to this, they claim that any negotiations that take place, that they have the right to do that in private. And so that's part of the dilemma, because I think, you know, our city business should be done in public. But so there's a little bit of a rub there. But anyway, that's their contention, and at least our city representatives up to this point haven't told us otherwise. When they came and spoke to us, one of their contentions is that there is a third aquifer. Kirsten's first picture showed a little circle at the base of Moscow Mountain. They contend there's a separate aquifer there. One of our city council members asked them if they would give us the name of their hydrologist, who they alluded to several times as being a very credible person. They didn't feel it was necessary to share that information. We don't know who that is, but as far as the city, well, at that point in time, I think the city felt the negotiations were about through and it was going to end up being decided down in Boise. But as a result of that meeting, I think it, you know, to the best of my knowledge, we're still negotiating.
What does that mean?
Okay.
What's going to go through?
I have this question, what are they going to grow? And no one seems to have a question. What are we growing here at the Naylor Farm? Is it rice that we need? What do they plan on growing?
The application that I saw, I read it, and I don't have it handy. I read it as organic materials. Veggies, I don't know. There's a person from Naylor sitting right over here. I mean, here's the guy to ask, I would think. I mean, they filed the water right application.
Well, I don't know that they specified that. I think it's for farm. You know, their statement to us is that we want to make this farm more profitable. We want to run it more efficiently. They claim they haven't done that for some time. And so I think the farm can also possibly be related to the clay mining. But that's somewhat
related to the platform,
clay mining.
Oh.
close. Could you speak to that? Because I feel a little strange trying to be the moderator and not speak as well. That I'm an intervener in the process of the daily clay.
When I asked a question about that, they said that the clay mining was only because they were going to use some residue of clay for a
organic
pesticide.
Yeah.
But it does take an awful lot of water to do clay processing. And it seems to me that other organic farms manage without using clay residue. So I began to wonder if this is maybe a scam and it's all about clay mining. But I that's only because I tend to be a cynic and worry about things.
Rachel, we heard a presentation earlier that the Blue Space Aquifer Committee a number of years ago entered into an agreement with both the state of Idaho and Washington that allowed for essentially the mining that we have while the committee functions in some form to attempt to correct that. Is there any enabling authority that you're aware of in either code or regulation that gives Idaho the ability to step outside of that mining prohibition?
No. The certainly the state has the authority to designate groundwater management areas or critical aquifer areas to study and determine what is try to get a handle on what's going on. And I don't know, has that occurred here? Has that designation occurred?
No, it has not occurred because we have a local. We have a local organization that's in place in lieu of. Right.
But to enter into an agreement that allows mining to occur while, we're fiddling while Rome's burning kind of approach to the problem. I will add that it is problematic when you have a whole lot of different water users who are pumping and it requires some centralized control to come in and assess and deal with that. Washington and Idaho ought to be entering into an agreement that would control the problem of aquifer decline. However, certainly our experience with the Spokane-Rathdrum aquifer is that it's very hard for the two states to get together to make that kind of agreement. And Washington and Idaho fight a lot over other issues, and that unfortunately colors the ability of the states to get together on the and address the problem of water quantity allocation. I know that some folks have looked at the agreement between IDWR and the Department of Ecology and questioned the legality of it, but I have to say I don't have an opinion one way or the other, but I know that there is some question about whether the two state agencies could have done what they have done.
If there were a citizen or a group of citizens that was pushing IDWR on that issue, is there a mechanism within IDWR, or is that something that has to go to the courts?
I think that it would be perfectly appropriate for this community to be asking IDWR what it is doing in terms of its long-term planning to protect the aquifer. If the work of the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee and whatever work is coming out of the MOA between the agencies is not accomplishing or giving you answers that you need to have, then it's appropriate to go back and ask the question. Obviously, you try to work it on a political level before you resort to litigation. Hard to say. If the hard questions have not been asked of IDWR, certainly that's the place to start.
I'd like to go back and respond to Mark.
Sure.
As I said, this arrangement is in lieu of Department of Water Resources and Department of Ecology doing anything. I mean, they have done nothing, and they have basically said, if you're willing to do it, go ahead, because they're not going to do anything. And so for the last 20 years, we have expended thousands of dollars in trying to figure out what's going on. And we wouldn't have gotten to the level of knowledge that we have, which admittedly is incomplete, but it's a lot farther ahead than had we depended on the Department of Water Resources to do anything. I think we have a very good, if you want to question the validity of the MOA between the two states that gives us some authority, the PBAC, I think we would have been in a critical groundwater or groundwater management area being run by the state, by Boise, with no local control. I mean, they sort of take the view, and I think in most cases, they take the view that operations undertaken at the local level is better than being run by state government 300 miles away. I mean, I can't justify it much better than that.
Rachel, I want to come back to what Kristen said. When you said that we're studying the aquifer and we're trying to see, we don't know if that's a resource or not for new water. From what you said, it's neighbors' responsibility, burden of proof, as you put it, to show to the agency that there is new water and that there is a barrier, or that it won't affect either of the other two aquifers. So my first question is that true? And my second is, I've never quite understood why the city's negotiating with neighbors in the first place, as John indicated earlier. And I particularly don't understand why it's negotiating privately, outside of public view, when all I would understand the city could be doing is giving its word that it's not going to oppose, it's not going to approve the water, that it's not going to oppose, as a city, the water application. And is that true? And if it is, why would we go to the city to negotiate privately for all of us what we're going to have to say in the application?
Good question.
Right.
Yes, the burden of proof is on the applicant. That is clearly stated in the law. And it makes sense if you think about it. If someone wants to use a public resource, they are the one, it's their burden to demonstrate that there will not be harm to the resource. As to the question of negotiations, you know, it's common for lawyers to want to try to conduct negotiations in private, but you have an uncommon situation here, which is that you have public entities, the cities, who are operating. I mean, why do the cities exist? I mean, they operate on behalf of their citizens, and so it might be appropriate to look at whether having a more open negotiation process is the way to resolve the problem. And if Naylor doesn't like that, then, of course, Naylor doesn't have to negotiate.
I'm a rural resident. I have several questions, and so I'm going to just direct them generally. So number one is I'm uphill from Naylor Farms about a mile away. We have four wells on our property, one of which produces water.
How deep?
About 150 feet. Produces the rate of about 4 gallons per minute. And other wells in the area produce between 1 gallon and about 15 gallons per minute. So they vary a lot. So first question is, if in fact there is a separate aquifer, are we in any danger? Secondly, if we are in danger and something happens to our well, as might happen to many others, what is our recourse? And thirdly, who is representing us?
That was too many questions. You got, what was question number one?
Question number one is are we in danger with a shallow well if there is in fact a separate aquifer there?
A shallow well could be overwhelmed by the effects of removing a lot of water. But I wouldn't be losing sleep yet. There's a lot of ifs before that would occur. You would have legal recourse. if that happened? I asked the lawyer. What would that be?
One of the other criteria
for a water right is that
it would have to supply it.
Is that the proposed new use may not harm other existing water users or senior water users. And under, you know, the prior appropriation doctrine, which governs water rights, that you know the rule, right? First in time, first in right. So legally, you are protected in your existing water rights. It is the obligation of IDWR to ensure that that occurs. However, I would not simply assume that they were going to do that, but you might want to be in touch with them to make sure that they're thinking about your interests.
As an individual.
You bet.
Because right now nobody is at the table
playing
the rules.
Yep, that's right.
Would he have to hire a lawyer?
It depends on the level of involvement that you want to have and or you feel like you need to have. Yeah. But if you wanted to get serious and legally intervene in the proceedings at that point, you might want to have an attorney get involved. It is possible to do it, though, as an individual. So
you can legally intervene right now. It's everything's on hold. Everything's in limbo. You can file a right to intervene for a hearing, at a hearing that may be held in the future.
How would I do that?
What?
How would I do that?
Contact the
IDWR.
Yeah, it's in. Yeah, it's a pretty straightforward process.
There's also some administrative regulations that tell you how to do it, and there you can get them off the web if you have access.
Yeah.
My question is, I understand that the reason that the private negotiations are taking place, this is what I heard, this is what we found out trying to ask questions, is that as long as they're negotiating, the city of Moscow could still dig a well, and they're talking about needing to dig another well. If this negotiation fails, and they go into a court proceeding, the whole time it's in a court proceeding, which can be years, months, years, nobody can dig a new well, which includes the city of Moscow. So if that is true, we could well be concerned that the city of Moscow was negotiating in some way that we don't really like in order to get this over with in case they want to dig a well. Do you think this is true?
Fairly him.
Well, if there is not already a moratorium on new wells out of the aquifer, there sure ought to be. I mean, you've got your aquifers dropping. You can't...
No, there's no moratorium.
No, there's no moratorium.
WSU is drilling a 24-inch well right
sure.
now as
sure.
we speak.
And is that for a new water right or a replacement water right?
Don't know. Just talk to the drillers.
I think it's a replacement.
Is that what Moscow wants, is a replacement right? Or
really gone prior to they have announced that they are thinking that they need one, and that's why I'm concerned. A couple of us have already applied and paid our $25 to be interveners, but we can't intervene at all, can we, as long as this is private. We have
sure.
to wait and hope that it gets to court.
Hearing.
Yes, and if it never gets to a hearing...
Well, if you've intervened in the proceedings, you certainly ought to be at the table. Now, if you have a lawsuit where you have multiple parties, some of the parties can break off and go negotiate, but the applicant still has to come back and deal with you. So, you know, I think if people have intervened, you need to be questioning why the negotiations are taking place the way they are.
And how do we do that?
Go to the city. Go to the mayors. Say, come on, time to open it up.
The negotiations are going on because the only interveners that had the option, that knew about the request, were the city of Moscow and the city of Pullman. The rest of us did not know, did not see the legal notice, and so they are the only legal interveners. The county, Latah County, which is the sovereign government in this area, did not file on time, and PBAC did not file on time.
Well, so the two cities are what are called protesters.
Yes.
But then after the protest period has elapsed, other parties can intervene.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
And it sounds like that's what you've done.
Yeah, and that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting to see. We're waiting for the hearing to be established so we can act as an intervener.
Well, why can't you participate in the negotiations?
Because apparently it's only being done between the two protestants that went to Water Resources and paid their $25 on a given day.
There's no law or rule that says that you can't participate in the negotiations.
Well,
you just have to convince the parties to open the door and let you walk in.
They haven't wanted us in, so we're out at the moment.
You think the cities would want the help?
Well, it's one of these strange things.
I do a little follow-up on the discussion we're having earlier about the mining of the aquifer. For those of you who don't know, I was a county commissioner in the early 90s and actually sat on the groundwater committee at that time representing the county. And my frustration at that time with the process of the committee was not along the lines of the action and research, trying to figure out what's happening with the aquifers and the other cities in the committee, but the absence of the committee's ability to put the pressure back on their sovereignty, the aquifer committee, back to the cities, back to the university, back to the counties, to say that, look, mining the aquifer, the research will have to be ongoing, but in the meantime, we have to stop sucking on this process. We're not talking necessarily just about drilling different wells. We're talking about each time that there's a new sewer hooked up, a new water hooked up, a new house, a new subdivision is tied into the city system. That's coming out of the deep aquifer.
Right.
That is the ultimate in conservation, is to cap the draw, or at least cap the growth on the draw. And those discussions, because they involve the very politically charged words of growth of what's the future of this community, we're conveniently ignoring what's been done. That's why I raised the issue as to is it appropriate and necessary at this time, given the highlight of the nail of the farm on focusing on this issue, to raise the pressure on the city to actually start the discussion of, well, maybe it's time to go to the IPLDR and say that, hey, look, the PVAC committee has done great research, but because of the structure of that committee and the regard it's held by some entities, it's not affecting the conservation measures necessary to decrease the mining or cease the mining. That sticks out there. Maybe some of the voluntary cooperative efforts that are really likely might actually happen. But my experience is sometimes the stick is like the rate of the mine or the crucial discussion.
You're absolutely right, Mark. I agree with you. And as I mentioned when we were talking about this, I listened to you. We tried to maintain a 1% growth. I mean, 1% limitation. You can't maintain 1% usage when the city is growing by 3% and 4%. I have gone to the city council time and time again, and the Pullman developer that comes over and built all the houses on the east side of Mountain View, I said, those guys are going to wipe us out. And they did. And it's a political issue. And, I mean, I don't want to be the sole white charger protecting feedback. But it's the politics of the situation. We try to do what the hell we can do. And if you go to the city and say, you have to slow growth or slow development or come up with some other process, and it doesn't work. The city council in Moscow hasn't met a developer it hasn't fallen in love with. So that's where I get very frustrated with the whole damn thing myself. But, I mean, we keep trying.
You don't, I mean, the PBAC doesn't have regulatory authority. What you need is to have...
We do have regulatory authority if we're told, and the agreement says that we have almost a final say-so on a water right.
Right.
If it comes to a hearing. But we can't get it past the negotiation. We do have some power.
I would suggest that in other places in Idaho where you have declining aquifers, the area has been designated as a critical aquifer.
We didn't want
area.
That.
Well, maybe you do want it now. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they've designated the Rathdrum Aquifer as a groundwater management area and have established a local advisory committee to help IDWR come up with the rules with how it's going to be managed.
But you don't have a moratorium on anything.
De facto.
They're still building houses in Coeur d'Alene and Post Falls and all over the place.
Well, that you can't stop the growth, but you
well,
can.
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. I'd like to stop the growth here for a little while, but you can't do it. And we can't maintain a 1% increase in water usage if you're growing at 3 to 4% per year.
Yes, you can.
Through conservation, but it won't make that much of a difference.
The way you do it is through controlling the water rights.
We tried to control it through pricing, through economic means, and it just seems to everybody just for the first month they raise hell about it, and then after that the water bill goes up and people send the check and you know off we go.
Tom, what kind of pricing are you talking about?
I'd like to see some serious pricing.
Well, yeah, and you know I've heard this many times that. You can't control it with price because people get habituated to the price and then it doesn't work anymore. But if you're talking about a nickel per 100 cubic feet, of course it doesn't work because nobody even notices.
That decision is made by the city council.
That's right.
It's political.
So PBAC does not have any regulatory control.
Of the pricing.
Or of anything else that's going to make a difference.
Except the water right application. We do have some control there.
Maybe.
The State Water Department is obligated to ask PBAC's opinion,
yeah.
But the sole decision rests with
the final decision rests with
State
it.
Water Department.
I agree. But we have a
and if they choose to
voice.
Entirely ignore what PBAC has to say,
I suppose they can.
You will have no recourse.
Yes.
That worked out well. I can tell you the city council is looking at a tiered pricing system. Okay. You'll recall when our water rates last year went up quite a bit. I think, you know, I wasn't there then, but I think our city leaders felt like they wanted to get a year under their belt of trying to get a concept of whether the current prices were at least coming out about a break-even situation for the city.
I think
that will become a more and more important topic of conversation and feedback or anybody in the community can lobby us to take a serious look at that and move forward with that. I wanted to follow up on the very important point Lois made about, you know, why is the city negotiating? The city's negotiating because if it gets down to Boise, the case that we would perhaps have to make is that we don't have the water for Naylor or anybody else to put in another well that would have that would use that much water. And just what Lois said, as soon as we do that, then we're in essence making the case that we shouldn't have the right to put in another well. And you said we couldn't, but what we have been told, and this information actually came from EWR at a recent breakfast meeting, and the representative there, I think his name is Jim Heen, said it doesn't close the door, but it makes it a lot harder to get through the door. So we still could make a case if we needed to put a well someplace else. Then we'd be more restricted to say, well, you know, the total water we're going to pump isn't anymore. If we were trying to get additional water, then it would be that much more complicated. So I think that's a key reason we're still trying to negotiate.
We've also heard the incompleteness of our science to date. I'm just wondering how burdensome that group needs to be. Given the uncertainty of the science, were the based on aquifer community or others to come forward with new knowledge of, say, a third aquifer, for example, are there any precedents for the state's retracting water rights when it's granted? And how much effort does Naylor Farms have to go through to demonstrate that they will not unreasonably burden the water resources of others.
Yeah, that's kind of a tough question. It goes to the question of evidence. If you have a dropping aquifer and it appears that the applicant will be tapping into that aquifer, you have a prima facie case that water is not available. So this question of the third aquifer is, I mean, I've certainly, in my career as a water lawyer, heard about lots of mysterious third aquifers. most aquifers are connected. For example, the Wanapum and the Grand Ron aquifers are connected. They are separated by what's known as an aquitard, which slows the rate of water flow or exchange of water between them. Nonetheless, they can and do affect each other. Whether there is this aquifer underneath Moscow Mountain, you know, this magical source of new water, obviously that's something that's very hard to know without drilling down there to find out whether it's there. There can be a process of what's called a preliminary permit process. I know they do this in Washington. I suspect they do it in Idaho as well, where an applicant can get a permit to drill a well to see what's down there. But until they go down there and check out what's going on, they can't actually get the water right to use all the water that they want. The depth of well that I think we're talking about here would be extremely expensive to do that. So I think Kirsten is right that you have a situation where applicants are reluctant to make that kind of investment unless they in fact do know that they're going to be able to get the water that they want. So
is one test well sufficient, or do they need three, or
at what time of year?
Yes, exactly. And right. 1 year, 1 season adequate, or
yeah, those are all different, depending upon the science that's needed, will dictate what happens in that situation. So it varies according to what kind of information you need to develop.
I'm not anti-growth, but some of the things I've seen occur in the city, I wonder if we could do more water conservation and have the city lead us in that. An example being, I just saw a plan for a church being developed on Joseph Avenue where they have an extremely large amount of grass, which requires a lot of water. And the plan was approved by the city. And the person that was going to try to complete this project, one of the church members, asked me what I thought of the plan. I said, the first thing you ought to do is get rid of the grass. Because of the cost of the water, the maintenance, etc. However, he said, well, we've had this plan just approved by the city, and this is what we have to do. So I'm just thinking that initially, if we can get the city to have a little bit more of an impact, to get the word out that we should have more conservation in Moscow by cutting down on our grass. A real prime example of this also is I have nothing against the Pollution Empire Mall, but I think we could have done the same thing out there without having all these islands of grass and having water running down on the pavement out into the streets and things like that. We could have done zero scoops, and that's what my business said that I have here in Moscow. I'm trying this year to promote zero scoops where they do use less grass in the yards. And if we did that, then we don't have to worry about the growth of Moscow as much. One of the other points I'm curious about, and maybe I don't know if anybody here would have an answer to that, but since I'm in business, I always look at the cost of things. How many gallons is a neighbor farm planning on taking out of the ground per minute to use this amount of water? So like 2,500 gallons per minute that they're going to pump out of the ground.
I heard
25 gallons maybe from a well.
I can answer to that. The original water right that they applied for was 14.5
1.43 cubic feet per second. They have amended that down to 5.43 cubic feet per second. So they have downgraded their water right. That figures out to be it's approximately 0.68 million gallons a year.
If they pumped all the time.
If they pumped all the time. And, you know, when you ask for cubic feet per second, that's what they're asking for that whole year's period of time. Whether they pump it all at once and put it in storage pond, or whether they pump it by the second, they can only take that much water.
Well, the point I'm trying to make here is, as a businessman, I don't know what they're growing out there.
Well, no one does. It's such a mystery. It drives me mad.
If they're pumping, let's say, 2,500 gallons a minute, the cost of electricity to pump that amount of water from 800 feet below the ground up and then use it and then irrigate it is a lot of money. And I don't know if that's going to be economically feasible for them to do this on a consistent basis and raise the crop and make a profit. So I think it might end up being a moot point. And I don't know, I just really can't figure out exactly what is going to grow out there to make a peaceful business.
I think the application said 1,000, they intended 1,000 foot well.
Yes.
Yeah. That's a tremendous cost. There's no question about it. Well number seven, well number nine out here by Palouse, you know, the big well that Moscow runs is at 1,200 feet. And it's a tremendous cost that we pay Avista to pump that water.
So we might be subsidizing neighbor farm if our water rates go up.
There's some, I have some questions about what the other farms are going to grow. I'm sure some of you already know this, but this is associated with Alchemy Ventures out of Canada, which is a mining company only in name. They don't actually do any mining. And they're the ones that wanted to put in this clay mine in Deere. It's like a venture, it's like a venture capitalist kind of corporation up in Canada. They wanted to put this mine in Erie to mine this high quality clay called kaolin. And the last I heard about the process is that they had made a lot of progress for the state of kind of faulting on water rights in Erie. So they were saying they were going to dry process the clay. Well, dry processing also has problems. I think it's more expensive, and it causes some air quality problems. And so then they became associated with Nalen Farms, and I'm not sure how that happened, but they're clearly associated with Nalen Farms. They're using the same geologists. They're using the same background, Lewiston. They're kind of the front people for this corporation in Canada. And they're talking about an organic farm that uses kaolin, and kaolin is the primary ingredient in kaopectate. So kaopectate does supposedly the insects will eat, try to eat the leaves that have been covered with this kaolin, and then a bunch of angry, constipated insects can go away or they die. And that's not the best, maybe organic method. I'm not sure other things can impact on that. But it would appear that they need the water rights more to process the high quality kaolin clay than to actually farm. So this brings tons of other issues because do we want a clay processing plant that we're not surrounding? Is that what we want our water to be used for? Do we want trucks shipping clay back and forth to the port of Lewiston where they would be shipping it then to Asia where it's used for clay ceramics? So, I don't know if you're thinking about that, but there's much more to this than some nice local farmer who just wants to grow organic.
Are there kaolin deposits under Moscow Mountain?
No, I think they're going to try to take some theory and practice
them. There is some kaolin in this area also.
Sure.
Well, yes, there's another criterion under the Idaho Water Code that said that forbids the grant of a water right for speculative purposes. And I can't remember all of the defining qualities or elements of speculation, but we certainly did raise it with one of the Rathrum power plant where a venture capital firm that had no track record whatever was proposing to build a $750 million power plant without visible assets to do so. So that is yet another factor that can be raised in the water right process, depending upon what you know about the corporation and its solvency and so forth. Yes.
When?
Well, they should have done it when they filed the application.
That's on the application.
Of the original water right, 12 cubic feet per second was for irrigation, 2.43 was for industrial. They have subsequently lowered that. They kept the 2.43 for industrial and dropped it to the 3 or 5 cubic feet per second to raise organic crops on 120 acres. Was the last letter I got from the other farm to explain what they plan on doing.
Well, I don't know what the process is for NCA to pass resolutions since we don't have a formal body, but I would certainly recommend that the board consider strongly taking the position of urging the city council as an MCA entity to open the process. I personally don't have a problem with the city representatives. I've not been terribly satisfied with the quality of legal advice that the city's gotten, and I haven't seen much of it in writing. So I would ask that if we're told that it can't be opened, that we get a legal opinion from the city council staff, understanding why it can't be opened. Because I think based on what Rachel has said, I'll be very surprised if it has to be closed. And then, as a second step, that others be allowed to come to the table. But those are two separate things, completely distinct. I don't see how we can keep up with what's going on if we're not aware of what that process is. Open meetings don't mean that people get to participate. It just means we get to listen. And we're not getting to listen. And what's going to happen is there's going to be a result, and we're going to be told all this bulk of information that city representatives have received in coming to an conclusion on our behalf. And that seems grossly improper to me, and I think as the MCA, we should take a position on
that. I think that's important for us to do, and I think that is to look at, is to open the process up more. I had a question just back a couple steps, and that is, how transferable are water rights? This is in light of the possibility of this water right might be used in a way that, for example, private corporations are purchasing water rights all around the world. The city of Atlanta, I think just in fact last week, decided not to have their water supply system privatized. In this era of deregulation and privatization, this threat of, I think there are two large companies, French one and American one, that own vast resources in all sorts of countries all around the world. La Paz, Bolivia, for example, raised the price of water at the tap by tenfold or something like that when it was privatized by acquisition by the French company that did that. At any rate, what prospect is there that Manor Farms is nothing more than a part of this Canadian group that is a part of this large reform will be purchased by them and our water is owned by private corporations?
Yes, it's the unfortunate aspect of the prior appropriation doctrine, which is inequitable in many ways, that water rights are viewed as a form of property right, and they are transferable. They may be sold and transferred.
And the use also can be altered.
That's correct.
So you can fight for anything.
And then potentially change the use to something else, yes.
You don't have to have a public notice of that?
Yes, there has to be public notice.
There has to be public notice of that, however. If you transfer it or if you move it, if you change locations, ranges and townships, that has to be and it has to go through the process, the hearing process, and it can be turned down. So there is some public protection from that.
Well, I believe there's also a provision that once you're granted a water right, you have to start using that water immediately.
No, 5 years, I think.
Yeah, 5 years and then another 5-year extension.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought it was sooner than that.
No.
I just really want to bring attention to those petitions because what we've been discussing here tonight is the local public interest and how important that is if any of us in the community don't have an invested water right that is directly affected by an application. We want to be able to continue to have voice in any of these discussions. This bill that has already passed the House, that's gone to the Senate committee, needs to be stopped. Please report to you that both of our representatives, Carol and Ringo, voted against the bill. Senator Schroeder's been contacted about it, and he was supposed to vote against it. He certainly could use the background of many people around here.
Why don't you pass some of the petitions back to get people going on?
I have a question on the ratio. It sounds like that part of this is being used for farm, part for industrial use. And at what point is it no longer a farm and it becomes industrial use? And do you have environmental impact statement requirements and a whole other body of legal processes? Who are they?
You know, in Idaho, you don't have an environmental impact statement process for strictly private enterprises. So, unless there's a federal trigger. So, we went through this with the both with the power plants and the Burlington Northern Fuel Depot up in Rathdrum, that no environmental impact statements was required. So that's a deficiency in Idaho state law. If a federal permit were required, then potentially that would trigger the Federal Environmental Policy Act. But I suspect that there is not a federal trigger here. So.
I'll take my life in my hands here and say a comment or two in favor of mining. We all use kaolin in this room. In ceramics, also in paper products, high-quality paper, magazines, books with photographs in them. Many products, consumer products, have kaolin in them. If we don't mine it here, if we refuse to have mining here, we will mine entirely in the third world where there are no environmental protections, where there's no concern simply because of the economics of the matter and the local politics for the things that Moscow residents will be concerned about. So as long as we're consuming this stuff, at least we got to recognize that it's going to come from somewhere. If not here, where? Be my question, but I'm a geologist.
Thank you very much for the survey of the Moscow Mountain.
Advisory Commission to the City Council. We have been asked by the Public Works Director to work on water conservation. Our commission is supposed to have 9 members, but we currently have 6. We need 3 at the end. We have 2 different issues that we're talking about here. One is what the city situation is, and the other is what neighbor situation is. And I think the neighbor situation has helped us all focus on the issue. Even if they had never applied for a water right, we would have a problem in this basin that we have to solve. And if that's important to you, I urge you to please let your city council members know. Let your county commissioners know. Let everybody know. Because it's an uphill battle to try to write a conservation plan, present it to the city council, if the city council doesn't think the citizens are interested. And so I think it behooves all of us to not just discuss these issues in a room and in a forum like this, which is a wonderful thing, but to also pass those views on to the people who are in a position to make a decision. And let them know this matters. Let them know you would like to see responsible stewardship of the resource. Let them know you would like to see growth controlled in certain ways, or ordinances about how much grass you can have around, you know, a new building. Or whatever ideas you have, I think they all need to come forward now and we need to work hard on this issue, because there are solutions for it. And we need to support the people that are already and have been toiling away on it for a number of years and give them our support too.
I just have a question for Richard.
If we have a case because the water is going down, so the water is not available, then why is there a negotiation at all?
Presumably because Naylor is arguing that there's a third aquifer.
Oh, it's that mystical third aquifer.
Right. It's the magical third aquifer under Moscow Mountain.
Well, in fairness to Naylor, there is reason geologically. It's not mystical and it's not magical. It is simply unknown. And unless someone drills, it remains unknown. And that's the way we've been living for decades. So perhaps that's the way you want to continue to live. But not drilling will guarantee continued ignorance on this point. Because PBAC and the counties are not going to raise the money to drill 1,000 foot or more.
We have 15 data loggers out right now that provide us information every second, and they run off on a printout, and we can pick it off a computer. And so we think we know where most of the wells are in the county. And we have approached county residents. Can we put a data logger in your well? And so we are trying to figure out what's happening. But it's just such an incredibly complex underground geologic structure. It just defies description. The computer models we had is an absolute piece of garbage now, because we have found lots of other material that contradict what we thought, you know, 1985. Is now in the junk heap, you know.
We were wrong.
Yeah, it was an error. So,
and I, you know, there may well be an aquifer down there. I guess what I would question is the water flows, just as Kirsten said, and so water flows from one aquifer to another. Sometimes there are barriers in between, but water is still flowing through it. So the question is, if there is a third aquifer, what is the relationship of that aquifer to your municipal aquifer? You know, I mean, there are a lot of important questions there that have to be answered.
Well, I think what we've also heard is the reason that the city is continuing the negotiation is they want to preserve their ability and right to drill additional wells for the city.
I think so.
Replacement wells on those drives. Additional wells in the city of Moscow. They argue against Naylor Farm being able to withdraw. They are essentially arguing against themselves being able to withdraw. So once again, gets to how much the city is going to grow, that they're going to need more water to maintain.
Do you think the water in the city well is just an exchange of wells?
I think it's a recourse for the water.
Kelly, I have a question for a lot of the people that are here tonight.
And my question is, the cities of Moscow and Pullman and the two universities have been mining the groundwater for almost 50 years. Currently, we're mining it to the tune of almost 3 billion gallons per year, and we seem to be pretty darn comfortable with that. But Naylor Farms comes in, and they're talking about now maybe 600 million gallons, and we're still just, you know, really upset about that. But our own mining to the tune of 3 billion gallons a year, somehow, you know, that can wait for a, you know, a solution someday. How do you reconcile those two things? That's anybody.
How successful was that mandated water conservation when the pump broke last summer? How did that work? If it worked, maybe that ought to be placed all the time.
Well, I think there, you know, and there's a lot of communities that do try to use, you know, regulations and ordinances to control water use. But, you know, people don't like to be told what to do. And if you say you can't water on this day, then the natural instinct is to try and find some way to circumvent that. And, you know, when there were every other day watering restrictions last August, you know, I had neighbors who would water twice, you know, run their sprinkler system through two cycles on the day that they could water to make up for the day that they couldn't. And that obviously was not saving any water. If you institute a rate structure which makes it increasingly more expensive to use increasing amounts of water, then you place the burden of regulation with each individual to determine how much they're willing to pay for the water and to prioritize their uses, and they will have to police their own use. And that, you know, to me, that's a heck of a lot better than instituting a bunch of regulations and then having to try to enforce them and decide what kind of fines and stuff are going to happen. So, you know, regardless of what kind of impact the regulations last year had, you know, for a long-term system of, you know, rewarding careful use of the resource, the financial incentive, I think, is by far better.
Could I just intervene here too? A show of hands, if you're willing to have the board develop a
the sort of inverse conservation. We were going to try to slow the rate of growth usage. In other words, only 1% per year kind of stuff. I mean, obviously we were going to conserve and try to back it off from a higher growth, from a higher use level.
So there's not a chance
of it? I don't know. You can't hold it when the community is growing and demanding more water. It just, you almost throw your hands up. It was just like it was putting your finger in the dike and then breaking elsewhere. It gave up on it.
John, if there's nothing coming into the system, the only way you're going to stabilize it is to quit taking anything out. I mean, it's just that simple.
You can. You know, the city of Seattle has made a decision that all growth, next 20 years worth of growth in that city, is going to be served water that is obtained through conservation. So it's a matter of commitment to do it, education. Pricing is a hugely important mechanism, but there are a variety of different things. You know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel here. It's been done in other places, but you have to make the commitment to do it.